we trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about. Okay, here we are for episode 6 of the In Tech We Trust podcast. Joining me today, HDL and Mark Farley. Hans, what are you up to, dude?
Sleeping.
Sleeping.
Oh, seriously, I woke up 1 minute after we were supposed to start recording because I already fell asleep in my couch. It's midnight here. Midnight.
You were reading a paper on Oracle storage, weren't you? What do you got going down, Mark?
Let's see. I got out of the office early so I could do this. It's the middle of the day here. What is it, about 3:20 in the afternoon? So I've just started drinking.
I was just going to say, have you got a beer?
I do, yeah. I've got a Speakeasy Tallulah Extra Pale Ale in front of me. Yeah, one of San Francisco's fine craft beers. Hey, I started doing my own craft beers.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's the biggest thing. Instead of recording a secret Windows phone app this weekend, my friend Tony, who works for NASA, and I, you know, brewed beer in my house. My wife was gone for the weekend, so we got the kitchen set up to do beer, and I'm making what's called a bodacious brown ale.
You ever done any of that, Hans?
No.
Is that kind of an American thing? Because I know whenever I'm over in the States, there seem to be a lot more of these like small local breweries going on, and a lot of the I'm not saying Americans are alcoholics, right, but it seems like a lot more Americans just you, Mark, a lot more Americans seem to be into that than Brits, at least.
Well, you do have a point. We do have some garage brewing over here, but that's mostly like for your own use or maybe small family use. What you have a lot now in the States is the microbreweries. I know for I was in Indianapolis earlier this year, and I know that in the last 5 to 6 years, they had over 35 new breweries in the city of Indianapolis alone. It's crazy. And one of the things that Americans do entirely different than we do, we have like these decades and hundreds of years of beer history and balancing out beers. You guys just throw anything at it and see what happens. And I have to say 9 out of 10 completely fail, but sometimes there's gems in there with stuff that has been thrown at that beer that we would never do. That's like, wow, this actually does come out quite well.
Yeah. So yeah, yours a failure,
you
Mark.
You named this beer Rat Eye. Does it really have rat eyes in it? Yeah. Is mine a failure? I don't know, right? You know, what's interesting about the microbreweries, I'm just going to comment on what Hans said. So there's this industry that creates kits. So you can cook up a recipe like some other beer that's out there. With all the microbrews, it means that there's more kits. And so as an experimenter brewing your own beer, and of course I'm doing it for my own household use here, as if I'm ever going to be able to drink them all. But and my buddy Tony, it's fun brewing beer with a rocket scientist, I got to say. But because there's a lot of kits available, you can experiment with a lot of different types of beers, which means a lot of different types of yeast and all this stuff. So, yeah, it's a wild, wild west for beer production.
And are you allowed to then sell that on?
Oh, no. No. I don't have a license to sell it. You know, I can give it to friends and that kind of thing. But The distribution of alcohol is heavily regulated.
Yeah. Does your house smell like a brewery then? Because I remember as a kid, right, the town I lived in used to have a local brewery. And sometimes when you'd walk on into town, you could smell it. So the neighbors all like, what the hell? The Farleys are brewing again.
No, it's not that bad. And especially when you're, I'm not quite sure the smell of the brewery, and Hans, you might be able to comment on this. It comes from the malts that you're doing.
Yes.
It's not the smell of the beer itself.
Yeah.
Right. Because you cook up the barley and the malt and in basically water, and you boil it down, and that creates food for yeast, right? What you do when you make beer is that you create yeast food, and then you know when you're done creating yeast food, you cool it down and you put the yeast in it, and the yeast turns that food into alcohol inside the brew. And so you don't really have the alcohol smell until you're done.
You know what, Mark, if you only knew half as much about technology as you know about brewing beers and feeding yeast and, oh dear.
Oh man, feeding, it's all about feeding yeast.
Your neighbors are just happy that the smell of pot is gone now.
Yeah. You can't grow your own here. It's against the law to grow it, even though you can buy it at dispensaries. But I haven't been doing that. My yard's too small. And besides, I've got squirrels that eat everything I try to grow. this little freaking squirrel, he took my last tomato this week.
That would be one happy squirrel.
Yeah, I should set up a smoke screen for the little bugger.
So then can we segue from microbreweries to microchips then? That was cheesy. Hey, wasn't? That's
yeah,
awful. That was,
yeah, very good. Yeah. Okay, keep going.
Well, I saw on the news this week that IBM's lack of love for hardware just knows no bounds. I see they're flogging off their PowerPC chip fabbing business to Global Foundries. So has anybody got any thoughts on that? I mean...
And they're paying for it.
$1.5 billion in cash.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd take that.
Who's using PowerPC anymore?
I'm guessing, right, that's half the reason that they're getting rid of the business, because there just mustn't be enough demand. I'm no expert on it, right, but I do appreciate that to be able to fab chips and things like that is a massive, massive operation. And if you're not like Intel or somebody that sells the kind of volume that Intel does, then that balance of the amount of investment and running the fabs and things like that just cannot weigh up against the profit that you're going to make if your market's not big enough.
I do think that it's a good thing, and you see IBM doing it in the last year, is that they're reevaluating their core business. And their core business is no longer in fabricating hardware. And I think it's a good move to I think IBM historically has been good at making those decisions at the right time. There's only one company that is as old as IBM, or not, it's not even as old as HP. But I think IBM historically has been the best at choosing at the right time to know what is no longer their core business.
But this isn't the right time, is it? I mean, this is way late. Surely they should have got off this bandwagon a long time ago.
Yeah, I think the last big commercial product line that used a PowerPC chip was one of the Mac laptops or notebooks or something. I think it was about 10 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I remember getting one of the first Intel MacBooks, and that was about 10 years ago. You're right.
Right. They switched off PowerPC. And I know that the PowerPC chip is terrific technology, an excellent chip, right? So they really had a tiger by the tail there. And I'd like to think that it was risk-based, but I can't recall. And I don't think they ever had a chance to backlog that. I don't, you know, so if they're not producing their own hardware, who's buying PowerPC chips? They don't have the ability to manufacture at scale like Intel, so they can't sell as cheaply, you know, or as low a price. So, you know, I don't know who in the heck bought them. Who's going to make these things and why?
So it was a company called Global Foundries. They're an Abu Dhabi-based business. I think they were originally spun out of AMD. I think I read that.
Ah.
But I don't know who they provide these chips to, because there's something in the deal that says they will, that IBM will still buy the chips from them. But aside from IBM, I don't know who else is going to do that. And why have they bought it? I mean, yeah, sure, you get $1.5 billion out of IBM, but that's probably not a lot of money in the long term if you've got to maintain fabrication plants and things like that.
Yeah, I'm looking it up right now on Wikipedia. I should have done this before. I'm sorry, Nigel. It is a risk chip.
Oh, it is. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it is. And you know,
and what platforms then do they use it in?
I'm trying to see. They use it in their mainframe systems.
Yeah, but they're like.
I know.
Unicorns these days, aren't they?
Yeah. So, in 2005, Apple announced they would no longer use PowerPCs in their Apple Macintosh computers. So that was, you know, almost 10 years ago, 9 years ago.
Which is a shame for IBM, actually, because I mean, I probably should have done some research on this too, but I think the Apple Mac is a lot more popular now than it probably was back then. I think it was maybe in a bit of a dip back then. I know when I bought the MacBook Pro, the 15.5-inch one that had the first Intel chip in it, I really didn't know anybody else that had a Mac other than me. Whereas now when I go to events and stuff like that, it's almost a 50-50 split. Are you a Mac user, Hans?
I am. I even was a Mac user in the start of the first iMacs and so on, and then the Power Macs. I had those machines, the G4 and so on, and then got into a few years of Microsoft machines, and now back on my old MacBooks. And then it's a homecoming when you come back to Mac.
Oh no, you've told me about that. I was nearly sick listening to you. Yeah.
But no, back to the story. The only thing that I just read vertically, or how do you say that, through an article that says everything about it, and there's nothing positive coming out of it, except for the fact that there's roughly 9,000 employees in that business, and that they want to do something with that.
So are they US-based employees? Because I know they've got some facilities in, like, the New York area.
Mm-hmm.
Does it say whether those are US employees?
That's probably that, yeah.
Yeah, they're probably up in Fishkill or Armont. No, probably Fishkill, I think, was where the chip manufacturing plant was for IBM.
So here's a question for you, and it's a total opinion question, right? Is it possible to be successful in chip manufacturing without exploiting, I'm going to call it cheap labor, but I think you know what I'm hinting at there. It seems that, you know, to have, I don't know, fabrication plants based on US soil just seems to be really bucking against the norm. Everybody else is like real, real cheap labor out in the East and the likes.
That's totally going to depend on the type of solution. I've met one of the players that makes the types of RAM-based PCI cards, and they're totally manufacturing that in the Valley, which is kind of one of the most expensive places to make something. They're building those chips and they're building those cards in the Valley because they are for the Army.
But isn't that like small scale and
yes,
a bit of a so niche
that's what
market?
I mean. It depends on the solution and the market. I don't think a global big volume type of chip manufacturing should be done in the States, not at all.
Or the Western world for that.
Yeah, I can't see how it can work here. I don't think we can get the manufacturing cost down here far enough. But I don't know. I don't know how much it depends on, you know, big wafers and all that, but I think you can manufacture, you know, you can set up manufacturing just about anywhere they've got sand, right? Which is everywhere.
Yeah.
So one of the things I'm reading here, by the way, is apparently these things went into the Nintendo GameCube, Wii, and Wii U. So it's been used for gaming. It was used in the Xbox 360, PlayStation 3. I think those are all pretty much not being manufactured anymore, right? Maybe the Nintendos are.
It was used in the Xbox 360?
Yeah.
All right, so I'm going to show my naivety here. I always just thought that was like a standard Intel Windows PC with a fancy cover on it.
It says right here, well, it's Wikipedia. How can it be wrong?
Oh, yeah, it must be true.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's interesting. You would think that a chip developed for mainframe architectures would not end up in gaming consoles, but that's where it did. Yeah.
Anything else on that?
Well, I'll just say this. That was a big deal for a while inside IBM. They spent a lot of resources developing that, and it was part of, I want to think that it was part of, I'm probably way out over my skis now, part of IBM's decision to go from bipolar to CMOS was the development around the PowerPC chip also.
Okay.
And so it historically has, you know, this kind of significance of, you know, pulling the plug on the big old bipolar mainframe systems and going to more modular, smaller CMOS-based systems. I think that was all part of that. So it's, you know, you probably go over to the Computer History Museum in Mountain View and find out some things about PowerPC.
Uh-huh.
Next time you're in town.
Been there once before, actually, a while ago, but it was a really cool place to go. You know, seeing all that old tech, some of the stuff I hadn't seen, but some of the stuff that I'd, you know, had and owned and seen around, that was, like, really cool to see.
Yeah, it's an interesting place. I haven't been there for a few years myself. And I used to work right by it. When I worked by Microsoft, I'd go by it every day. Shame on me for not stopping in. Hell, there probably would have been weeks I could have gone over there and just hung out and nobody would have known.
You could have done that when you were working at HP or Dell or Microsoft. You can just
go
and hide in a
company. Exact. I could have just, you know, walked over, gotten a season pass or whatever. You know, become a member.
Yeah. Is there Wi-Fi here?
Carrier pigeon.
So should we switch gears again a little bit then? And we seem to talk a lot about EMC at the moment, but you know what? They're an awesome company and they do a lot and they do a lot well. They're in the news again this week. So they're bringing VCE back into the, well, into the EMC Federation. And some potentially interesting topics to talk about. Cisco reducing the amount of funding they're putting in there. What are your thoughts?
That's where it starts. I mean, it's the fact that VCE is now coming under the umbrella, the Federation of EMC, that's the result. The origin is that Cisco bails out. Not entirely. They're going from 35% stock to 10%. But Cisco just said, you know what, guys? We're done with this. That's all. And everything else you read is this is just Cisco filing for a divorce, and everything else is let's make it sound good for the kids.
So, why do you think they're filing for that divorce then? What's the what's going on behind the scenes that's made it get so ugly that they need to file?
Well, Nasira was the whore that tore him apart.
You think so?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if we're going to use that analogy.
Yeah. I think you're going very well with the analogy there.
I had a blog post where I kind of used this stuff too today on it. So, but yeah, I think it was very difficult for Cisco to deal with the fact that VMware spent $1.4 or $1.35 billion or whatever, you know, on Nasira to do software-defined networking.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, really, you guys, hey, did you ask us?
Mm-hmm. That kind of thing was always potentially going to happen, though, wasn't it? I remember when they first set up VCE, and everybody's like, you know, they're not just two awesome companies here, but the guys that are at the head of them as well. You got Joe Tucci on one side, and you got John Chambers on the other side. And these guys are guys with big egos and you know, passionate guys, and it was always like, oh, this is going to go south at some point, I always thought, at least. I guess we've got as well, and it's not as, it was certainly wasn't anywhere near as large an acquisition, but Cisco's acquisition of Whiptail as well on the solid-state storage front was potentially another kind of kick in the kahunas in the other direction.
Yeah, but to come back to going south, I don't necessarily see it that way. It's not because we have a divorce now that the product that came out of it or the business that came out of it in the last 4 years has been bad.
No, I meant the relationship.
Yeah, it has been good for both companies. I mean, EMC and Cisco got a lot out of it. Don't forget that they're doing a run rate of $2 billion this year.
Yep.
VCE alone today is $2 billion. I mean, that's not a bad business.
They're pretty much a startup as well.
Right. Well, yeah, but
it's not. But the one of the questions around that, Hans, is around profitability. They're selling that much. Are they making any money?
I can only hope so.
Yeah, I don't know.
There's been a lot of talk in the past that they haven't been making money. I know the Register and the usual places used to put out articles saying these numbers don't look very good. And I'm not a numbers guy, but then there'd always be come back from, you know, VCE guys or EMC guys saying, well, it's not as simple as that. And yes, we are making money and it's a long-term investment and all of that kind of stuff.
No, but seriously, how bad do you need to screw up if you got a revenue of $2 billion to not make any profit?
Well,
no, help me out here. Hey, Mark, you've been in a dozen companies that size. How bad do you need to screw up if you have a revenue of $2 billion not to make any profit?
Well, all you have to do is have your run rate exceed that, right? And I have no idea, but these rumors have been around for a while. I agree with Nigel. So
I don't think it's ever been put to bed, has it? Nobody's ever come out and said, hey, you know, we're making money hand over fist here, or the numbers have always been a bit grey and there's always been, well, we're not getting the full picture here.
Well, and the other thing too is you don't know what VCE was buying the products for from EMC and Cisco. So you could have a scenario where both EMC and Cisco are making a bunch of money on the products they sell to VCE, and VCE is, you know, basically overpaying for them and not making money, and everybody's happy.
I could definitely see that
absolutely
happening.
Yeah.
But hey, but that's rumors again, right? That's just guessing. We don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one interesting thing I thought was that Cisco UCS, I've never seen a great deal of it out there. Awesome platform, actually, in my opinion, but I don't see a lot of it out there. And I know it's a tough market. The Cisco UCS that I did see out there in the wild did always seem to be as part of a V-block. And I thought that was kind of interesting in that, well, Cisco seemed to be backing out of this a little bit. Like you say, they've dropped from 35% of stake in the business to about 10%. So they must be selling UCS elsewhere outside of a V-block as well. But all the ones that I saw in the wild were either a V-block or a FlexPod.
Yeah, but that's what I mean with everyone got something out of it. Cisco was nowhere in the server market before VCE, nowhere. They started with the product. They had no credibility in the market. VBlock gave them the credibility in UCS and the server market, and they can grow on that today. They have that. I think the market agrees now that that UCS as a platform is one of the better players in the market, and they can work on that now. They could never do that before VCE.
Yeah, and I think the interesting part about that, Hans, is that not only did it give them a footprint, but it gave them sales to continue to justify further engineering work on it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so yeah, here's our channel. Our channel for UCS is VCE, and it's bringing in money. And this is why I think they probably got decent margins selling to VCE. I think it was very good business for Cisco, and it really allowed them to continue to develop, you know, a very good server platform.
It's interesting because it's a very intelligent server platform. It's very high-end in the features that it offers, and it's almost more than just a server platform, really. But when you compare it to something like Supermicro and Quantra and things like that, you buy a bit of bare metal and you wrap everything yourself around it. Very much the opposite of that.
Yeah.
And there's a strong push in the market that's going towards, you know, those cheaper commodity white box servers. I always thought when they came out with UCS, looks like a cool technology and I like what they're doing, but is the market going in that direction? And I'm still not sold on that.
It's a different type of customer you're going to. And I definitely see a market in the higher enterprise customers, which are the ones that VCE, VBlock Systems go after. They don't necessarily need the cheaper sheet metal that comes from a Supermicro. They're kind of okay with systems that are more intelligent and more robust, more mature, like UCS platform. And by the way, it's not because Cisco dials back out of this marriage that you're going to see UCS no longer be part of VBlock. It's not. I think Cisco gave VBlock back to EMC, but you're still going to see UCS servers and Cisco networking in there. That's my guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
There was a canned statement that said something along the lines of VCE will continue to bring to market best of breed technologies from EMC, Cisco, and VMware, which I thought was kind of funny. What, best of breed within EMC and within Cisco? But what it didn't say that it would continue only to bring to market best of breed techs from those companies. So I wonder, you know, is the door open now for VCE to start packaging together solutions with technologies from other vendors?
Well, that's probably what the 10% stock for Cisco still means, right? It's no longer a separated joint venture. It's part of the federation, but Cisco still has their 10%, and that's probably going to be to ensure a little bit that they have a majority or at least a priority in the products in VBlock. Maybe there's going to come a second line, but I think VBlock as such does tell it's going to be Cisco, EMC, VMware.
So, you know, the whole thing is really interesting to me, how Cisco can retain 10% ownership when it goes inside EMC. These things just kind of boggle my mind. So I guess it's an independent entity inside the Federation as much as possible, right? So it's independently accounted for and all that?
I guess so, yeah. So VCE reports into, and you guys help me out here, right? It reports into the EMC Information Infrastructure part of the Federation. Help me out here. Do you pronounce that EMCII or EMC2? Because when I look at it, no, seriously, when I look at it, I'm like, oh, EMC2. Oh, no, wait a minute. That stands for information infrastructure. So how the hell do you even say that?
You got me.
I hate stuff like that. So, yeah, but that is the way I see it. So VCE reports into EMC information infrastructure. But then below that, there's that little kind of 10% dotted line with a Cisco badge underneath it feeding into VCE. And as far as I'm aware, I don't know. Oh, no, because actually, elsewhere within the EMC Federation, I think, is it Pivotal? General Electric has a small share in that as well. Mm-hmm. And so I think that they've got a bunch of these other companies that feed into the Federation.
Well, that's right? It's just stock. I mean, it's not one company. It's different companies under a Federation, and different companies can have different sets of stockholders. I'm okay with that.
Oh, I'm okay with it. It's just kind of like, whoa, this is complicated. And actually, you know, I don't want to talk about Elliot really today, but we've talked about Elliot in the past and the kind of relatively small stake that they've got in EMC, but the waves that they're trying to make. Is this move here by moving VCE into the EMC Federation and also by having the likes of Cisco feed in, GE feed in, other people feeding in, does that make it harder for Elliot and anybody else to break up the Federation? And is this, you know, is this Joe here strutting around on stage and cupping his kahunas in front of Elliot saying, stick that in your pipe, guys?
Well, it makes it harder for Elliot to demand a sale and that these other companies are stockholders that would probably vote against him.
Uh-huh. I'd hope so.
Yeah, well, one would think, you know, if you've got a 10% stake in VCE and Paul Singer comes out and says, you got to sell VCE, you already know that 10% of it's going to vote no. Probably, but you never know. I mean, it could be that at some point Cisco could say, hey, we can make a lot of money off this thing, take it.
Are you guys in favor of the EMC Federation? You think it's a good thing?
I think it's just one of those rare places in our industry where it actually works.
Totally agree. Mark?
I think it's a brilliant strategy that, you know, Tucci and his management team put together. I really think it's smart. My hat's off to the EMC management for figuring it out. I think it's a great defense, a great offense. It's a great way to move talent around within the Federation. It's just freaking dynamite.
Yeah, well done to them.
And great special teams.
Yeah.
So what do you think about VCE as a concept then? I know those guys have been around for a while and the market is a lot more mature, the converged infrastructure market, that is, a lot more mature than it was when those guys came around. They've been at the forefront of pushing it, I guess, in a lot of ways. What are your thoughts on VCE and what they do?
That's a very good question now. Now that we don't have Cisco necessarily there, it is... I challenge the fact that it should be a separated company within the Federation. I don't see a lot of extra value as in being an EMC product line where VMware and Cisco is used as secondary products. I don't see this necessarily as a separated company other than a product line.
That's interesting.
You know, it is interesting. I think the converged infrastructure business is going to be a big one, and VCE was the flag bearer for converged infrastructure, and to a large degree, converged infrastructure is now being synonymous with private cloud, and so converged infrastructure, private cloud is going to be a really big thing, and VCE really started that ball rolling. So now there's this whole other market around it. Cisco is going to be a player. I believe that Cisco wants to be there. How are they going to do that? You know, are they going to buy somebody? That's probably not possible for them to do another spin out, spin in. My guess is they're going to plunk down some money. They've got a deal right now with Simplivity. You know, people are looking at, can anybody afford to buy Nutanix? You know, there's other companies out there, Maxta. You know, and I think Cisco will make a play, and it'll be very interesting to see how this plays out.
I think it's interesting that they had this whopping 35-36% stake in VCE. And VCE, like we say, they've been at the forefront of this. VCE are almost synonymous with converged infrastructure, and vice versa, I would say. Yet they've dialed back the investment that they've got there, but the market, the converged infrastructure market, still got way more potential. You know, we're still in the early days of it. And that kind of perplexes me a little bit, unless they've got something else up their sleeves. But they seem to be, or VCE, in my opinion, seems to be in a great position to, you know, maximize as this market grows and progresses. Why would they want out?
Well, because the VCE, the V block is a big thing. It's a pallet. And the entry point to get into one is a lot of money. What's going to happen with converged infrastructure is, you know, like you see with Nutanix and SimpliVity and Scale.io and these companies, Maxta, you see very low cost entry point. And I think this is the thing that Cisco and EMC both are looking at. And, you know, who knows how long VCE as VBlock will be around. My guess is you'll start seeing smaller modules that scale up, scale out in very interesting ways so you can cover the threat, you know, that Nutanix poses and other people might pose.
Yeah, I think the VBlock as such does serve a certain type of customers, but both of the companies, both Cisco and EMC, will have to go somehow into that hyperconverged node-based architecture model. I think EMC already publicly announced that they're going to do something like that before the end of the year. I'm not sure around which product they're going to build it, but they are planning to get into that market. But it still makes sense to have both types of convergence, because converged infrastructure in the likes of VBlock is still different components of compute, storage, and networking separated, but just in a single SKU with some management tools on top of that. The hyperconverged market is something completely different. This is node-based architecture, where we actually dived into last week. It's a different market. It's a different type of selling. It's a different type of customer. I think they both have still viability, but they both Cisco and EMC have to go into that node-based architecture model. They have to.
So if one of those guys picks up SimpliVity, let's say, then holy cow, there's a race on for Nutanix, right? There would be, surely, because I personally, and this is just from a technologist perspective, right, I much prefer the Nutanix and SimpliVity type architectures versus a VCE, a VBlock, sorry. Whereas I think VBlock and VCE have done a good job and they've almost created and pioneered a market there, I do think architecturally it's ugly. It's a pig with lipstick, like we say, yeah? And these hyper-converged... but it is. And these hyper-converged architectures in comparison... I better not say it because my wife wouldn't be happy, but, you know, they look... just a ton better. And if one of those guys
You didn't say anything just there that your wife wouldn't like. What were you thinking?
Well, if we've got a pig with lipstick at one end, at the other end we've got, well, yeah, we won't go there. But as soon as one of those guys gets picked up, there's got to be a race on to pick up the other guys, because you don't want to be the only major player out there in infrastructure that doesn't have a proper hyper-converged solution. And, you know, if Nutanix gets bought or whoever, the other guys must be rubbing their hands thinking, oh, dear me, we're going to be raking it in.
Well, if you look at all the players in the market we have today, the most mature products would indeed be SimpliVity and Nutanix in the VMware realm. I'm not sure Nutanix is waiting to be bought. I think Nutanix is probably looking first at an IPO. SimpliVity might be a good fit for Cisco. But in the end, I'm not sure EMC does not have something else up their sleeves.
Does EvoRail play here for those guys? No?
No. EvoRail is the OEM solution for all the A brands that do not have an answer to SimpliVity and Nutanix. EvoRail is not going to be the big product for EMC. EMC is going to have something of their own that probably plays multi-hypervisor, that probably plays into OpenStack. I'm not sure, but they're going to come with something of their own. And I don't have an idea today what it could be. I don't even have a guess. But it's definitely not going to be Nutanix.
Yeah, I think I agree with you, Hans. I think that Nutanix wants to do the IPO, I think their price would be extremely high. You know, they're riding a big wave right now. Why would they? Why would they sell? I just don't. I don't see that.
Yeah. If the price is right.
Yeah, I don't. Ooh, wow. I don't know. I mean, then you have to ask your question: is it worth it? EMC that has VMware in the stable and could probably make the question's been raised in the past: how much intellectual property does Nutanix have? Right, they've got this great position in the market, and they've been very successful selling. But do they really have that much defendable IP? And you know, the companies like EMC really look at this and they say, why would we spend? You know, why would we spend? What would it cost to buy Nutanix? $4 billion? $5 billion? You know, I don't know.
Something. Wow, that's a lot. Yeah,
probably a lot.
Yeah, it's going to be in that range.
It's going to be in that range. And you're thinking, if you're going to spend that much capital, why don't you just develop your own stuff? I mean, you can buy another company a lot cheaper, and
but it's not that easy to develop, is it? Because it takes time, and we've said this before. It doesn't matter how much cash and how many developers you throw at a new technology. It's really difficult to buy time and that catch-up time. I think that EvoRail is a potential way in for them there. If they see that some of the competition's getting a one-up on them, you know, Simplivity, Nutanix, whether they get bought or not, that it wouldn't be too hard, in my opinion, for EMC to take EvoRail and really productize that themselves and shaft over the OEMs in the process. I'm not saying that they would, but I don't think it's off the cards in the long run.
It has, by definition, vSAN included in it. And I'm not sure EMC will want to have their hyperconverged solution be tied to vSAN.
Right. No, I agree with you that the vSAN's limitations may keep it from being able to scale. So Maxta out there, however you say that, the CEO of Maxta, Amar Rao, was the CEO at Kashia, which sold to EMC, and Amar's got all these great connections there. You know, I wouldn't be surprised to see EMC spend a lot less for a company like Maxta and then just build out, you know, and that would give them a lot of software. I have no idea how Maxta software compares to Nutanix or Simplivity. I just don't know. But even if they had a software solution that wasn't quite up to speed, they certainly have that killer sales ability that would allow them to compete.
Yeah. Why wouldn't they be able to do it with Scale.io?
That's a good point.
They could too. I don't know. I mean, they'd have to. There are other options I could buy. I just happen to know the history there of Amar, Amar at Maxta and EMC. And my guess is he's keeping very close tabs to those guys and talking to them all the, you know, every other week probably now.
So I need to go and look up those guys because I really don't know how they work, what they've got.
Their whole thing was they were trying to do hyper-converged infrastructure, but software only. Buy your own white boxes, right? And it's kind of it's an interesting idea considering what hyper-converged infrastructure is about. It's like, okay, you mean I have to integrate my own boxes? But that's what they were working on.
Well, they're just a storage layer, right?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I should have to look it up. Maxta.
Yeah, I know. They're.
I'm spelling it for our listeners, Hans.
Yeah, sorry.
It's all right.
But they're just a storage layer. I mean, there's more than just the compute and the storage layer. There's also bringing it together and doing cluster management and all that stuff. And there lies the big challenge.
Yep. If you're going to scale out, you really need that stuff.
Yeah.
Always easier said than done.
Yeah. And I think you made a good point earlier when you said about Scale.io, Hans. I've always thought that EMC being the majority owner of VMware's got vSAN and they're heads down and developing against vSAN, and that's going to become I think I read recently that there's talk about there being 64 nodes in a cluster, which would be pretty scalable. But then on the other side, EMC, the parent company, has acquired Scale.io, and you've got these kind of two competing software-defined storage solutions, if you will. Never quite understood how they would position one against another. But like you maybe suggest, Scale.io could be used as that layer in a hyper-converged product to come out from EMC. That would be interesting.
Well, it takes us a little bit back to our discussion of last week. What's the benefit of kernel-based distributed storage or VSA-based? And you could do a VSA-based on Scale.io that does cross hypervisor, and which does not compete with the kernel-based VMware storage vSAN, that it totally makes sense. It makes sense from an EMC standpoint, not putting everything on vSAN for their own products.
Scale.io was the technology I thought when I first looked at it looked like it was going to be awesome. I thought this is a product that could take the market by storm. I kind of thought, and this is just memory, right? I thought that they had a product that was that would play with the Windows kernel and the Linux kernel, but not one for the VMware kernel. I need to go do a bit more research on that as well. But can I throw a question out with regards to converged stacks and hyperconverged? It's lock-in, and I'm not a fan of lock-in. So you buy hyperconverged, and you are locked in by definition. Is the kind of simplified IT that it brings worth that lock-in as a trade-off?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so there's multiple layers of problems in data center architecture that you're solving with that. It is buying cycle that minimizes it to node-based buying, single SKU buying. It's installation-based. The installation is just add a node to the architecture. It's moving one node out of the architecture, and that for everything in your infrastructure. You're really playing on, you're doing private cloud, but platform as a service to yourself. And that's what you get out of this. It's the spinning up a VM in Amazon, not knowing what is the underlying infrastructure. It's the exact same thing you get for your private infrastructure. I definitely see the lock-in into a certain technology being the benefit over all the other things that you're eliminating here. There's a lot of time that you get for free by going into these type of technologies. And more, if you look at the higher layers, the virtual machine as such is more and more becoming a mobile thing. We can move virtual machines between hypervisors. There's still some tricks to be done today, but we're slowly coming to a point that we can move virtual machines between hypervisors, between public and private cloud. So what does it matter that you are locked into your platform if you can switch platforms?
That's a great question. If you can switch platforms, it's not locked in.
Exactly.
But we're not quite there yet, are we?
We're close. We're really close to moving VMs. It's not on the fly yet for everything, but you can move VMs from a VMware platform to a Microsoft platform to a KVM platform. It's doable. So if the platform as such, and this is already on a hypervisor level, what you were asking is, how can I afford a storage lock-in? How can I afford a management of my infrastructure lock-in? It's even higher. The lock-in is not even there anymore. The lock-in is a lot higher. I don't care about that infrastructure lock-in at all.
So as long as you have mobility or portability of your VMs or applications, I guess is what it's about at the end of the day.
Yeah, even application would even be better. If I can have an application running at the same time on a VMware infrastructure and a KVM infrastructure, wow, that's Valhalla, right?
That is the holy grail. Hey, I want to change things up. I've got a question for you guys. Speaking of infrastructures and different kinds of stuff, this week Microsoft announced their cloud platform system, otherwise known as CPS. They call it Azure in a Box. Did either of you see anything about that?
I've seen it happening, and other than some Microsoft fanboys, I haven't seen anyone really reporting on it.
Well, I've not seen much on it, but I'll say this, Hans. I did see a tweet maybe about an hour ago from Enrico, and it seemed very favorable. And I wouldn't call Enrico a Microsoft fanboy. He's a guy that I've got a lot of respect for.
Mm-hmm.
Mark, to answer your question, I don't know enough about it. I'll do some reading about it before next week's show. But based on Enrico's tweet, not that I'd ever make a purchase decision on that alone. But no, Enrico seemed to think it was a good thing. He was suggesting he'd like to see more people do the same.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. You know, they're trying to build like sort of a mini VCE Dell is their Cisco, providing compute, and I think they're providing not storage arrays. They're providing just basically JBOD that mm-hmm. works with storage spaces, you know, inside the Microsoft server 2012. So the storage is managed by spaces. The whole thing is managed, I think, by System Center, and of course, it uses Microsoft virtualization.
You know what, for me, and this is why it's going to fail, in my opinion, the only intent of the appliance is getting more companies into Azure. If that is the only intent of the appliance, that's going to fail.
Why do you say that? Because a lot of traditional enterprises, I know Rick's been a big proponent of this on the show in previous episodes, you know, these traditional enterprises that have got Exchange, SQL Server, SharePoint, all the Microsoft portfolio, then Azure's a great choice for those guys. Then, if I understand what you're saying right here, Mark, this is then like a private cloud type appliance that you can have, and you can host stuff on-premise and then send it out to Azure and back as and when needed, yeah?
It is definitely private cloud appliance. This is not the way they build their own clouds, but the idea is to have...
But it hooks into their own cloud.
It does hook in, and it includes something called Azure Pack, which is Azure services that run on premises, right? And not all the services are the same, so you know it's not like you've got complete integration, but the idea is that you can then integrate all of these applications, SharePoint, Exchange, you name it, with what's in Office 365 in the cloud. And so
that's what I mean. It is a private cloud as such. So technically the box is going to be a private cloud, but the intent of it is to be a public cloud gateway.
That's all right. I like the idea of that conceptually.
I'm not sure how much of a lifespan that has as a product. It's an in-between product to get people from the private cloud to the public or hybrid. And I'm not sure how much an appliance as such is the product to get there. I mean, it's a good solution as an in-between solution to get accustomed to the hybrid cloud. I'm not sure it's that big of a news.
But isn't it totally the opposite of something like an OpenStack-based solution, where we've said frequently in the past that, you know, to implement something like OpenStack as your own private on-premise cloud takes a lot of knowledge and a lot of effort. Whereas something like this, as long as it's packaged properly, you know, you can land it in your data center, rip the shrink wrap off, plug in a commando socket to the back of it, and away you go, and you're plugged into Azure on the back end, public cloud as well. Why wouldn't I like that?
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it's just plug in and go.
I get that. And what I'm saying is, maybe compared to something like roll your own OpenStack, it's the equivalent of a plug-in and go.
Right.
I shouldn't speak as if I've got any authority on this, because I really don't know about it. But conceptually, it sounds all right to me.
Well, the Register did have an interesting article on it. And the thing that they picked on was System Center. And they thought that Satya Nadella and Scott Guthrie, you know, seemed to want to cover that up and not spend too much time talking about System Center as the management point for this thing. I want to say this about those two guys. Satya is okay. Scott Guthrie is amazing. I really think that he's a terrific technologist for Microsoft. It's very interesting listening and talking to Scott Guthrie. The guy's really enthusiastic. Another thing that happened this week at Microsoft with cloud, by the way, is they hired apparently a guy who used to run Amazon's infrastructure to run Azure's infrastructure. I'm not sure at which level he ran infrastructure at Amazon, but he is reporting into Guthrie. He's reporting into Scott Gu, and he's got the job of making sure that Azure's operations come up to speed, probably equivalent or better than Amazon. It's going to be very interesting to watch.
Sounds like an interesting acquisition there of talent.
I just quickly went through the article that goes behind that tweet of Enrico, and his idea, and where he said, "Others please follow," he's pointing at, for example, HP that has their own public clouds. Why don't you make it easier for us to consume that? So the same thing as I said, that type of model of kind of a public cloud gateway, making it a hybrid cloud, giving us that appliance. And that was his point, to please follow for the others.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I think a product like this should be strategically important to Microsoft, but it kind of doesn't look that way. Now, the fact is they had Satya Nadella and Scott Guthrie making the announcement for this thing, but one of the few advantages that Microsoft has competitively against Amazon and Google is the fact that they've got this, you know, installed on-premises infrastructure, and they know all about that stuff and how people use it, and Amazon really doesn't, and Google really, really doesn't. And so, you know, they have this on-premises enterprise knowledge base that they could leverage, and then they come out with a product like this, and as far as I could tell, it was, you know, they may have tried, but it just didn't get anything. They got nowhere with it, the announcement anyway.
You know what my first thought, Mark, when you started explaining it was, Microsoft plus Dell, this has got Farley written all over it. You got out at the wrong time.
I knew this.
That could have been you up there announcing it.
Yes. I knew this product was coming. It was in the same group that I was in at Microsoft. So that was always something that I, you know, I've known about for.
And you still chose to jump ship, but it can't be that good then.
But it doesn't have It doesn't have parts of StoreSimple in it.
Nope.
Nope.
No StoreSimple in it.
What's going on with StoreSimple there these days?
Well, they had a new product that came out in June last year, and they're working to, you know, market it and sell it. I really haven't talked to them to see how it's going. I assume it's still going well, but I don't know.
Personal opinion time. Has the acquisition been good for StoreSimple?
The acquisition was fantastic for StoreSimple.
I don't mean like as in how much money people got and stuff, not that I'm suggesting that's what you were referring to, but long term for StoreSimple, you think it was the right move?
Absolutely, and Microsoft invested quite a bit in developing the market as well as the development team. Heavy investment made by Microsoft in StoreSimple. So it was not a case like there have been some companies and products that got bought by a large company. For instance, PolyServe and Left Hand were examples of two really excellent storage technologies that languished and got starved at HP. That was not the case for StoreSimple at Microsoft. Microsoft loved them, gave them money, gave them a lot of people, said, here you go, you get special status as far as funding inside the company. You know, we were sort of cloistered off. We weren't a wholly owned subsidiary, but we had the ability to have resources that other people that we were working with didn't get. So they really did take good care and feed StoreSimple after that acquisition. I was very impressed with the way they did that.
But that's good internally. Externally, I haven't seen that much coming out of it. Most of the times when you speak about Microsoft and you speak about storage, you're going to hear about storage spaces and all the features that they have built into 2012 R2. I haven't heard that much of StoreSimple in the last year or last 24 months.
Yeah, so there weren't announcements until in June. And yeah, actually, I meant July. They were in July this year. And the way Microsoft does announcements anymore is really kind of, I think they've lost the plot. And so they, internally, the metrics there are that, oh, we did a great job. But externally, I knew, and this is one of the things that was driving me nuts, that nobody knew or nobody cared, just like the announcement this week. You know, nobody knew or nobody cared about Cloud Platform System. You know, so the criticism always of Microsoft is that they become so insular that they don't know how the rest of the world thinks about them. And that's certainly the case. And they need to get some real feedback in on these things. So StoreSimple was doing well. The product growth was terrific. We had some tough numbers to meet, and we did. But it wasn't being talked about. And, you know, Microsoft just doesn't really know how to talk about all that stuff. They've got a lot of other things that they do want to talk about. And it confuses. Microsoft's the kind of company that when they talk, people get confused. And I think that's a big problem for them.
And they have got a hell of a portfolio as well, though, right? So, I mean, where do you start with something like that? Trying to get good, consistent messages across. Ow.
Yeah, but I will say this in StoreSimple's. I mean, if you go back and you look at the July earnings report, StoreSimple's mentioned in it, right? Satya Nadella talks about StoreSimple. This is a little company that was acquired, and you know, we were doing really well. So I know what you're saying, Hans, but at the same time, the company was making an attempt to promote the success that they were having with it to the point that it's in an earnings call.
Yeah.
And not a lot. I mean, you know, not a ton of attention. You know, Satya gives everybody a lot of love, but it was there. so it really is doing well. It's just kind of invisible to most people.
Speaking of earnings calls, we've had a rumor Extreme.io doing pretty well in EMC, and they put it on the earnings call of now Q3 that they said they're in a run rate for 500 million. Who believes? I can hardly believe it. When there were rumors, I couldn't believe it, but now it's on the earnings call with that number. I just don't see that happening.
That's for the year, though, right? Not for the quarter.
I know, but 500 million run rate still means at least 125 last quarter.
But they may be fudging a little bit on that and saying that 500 million run rate starting now. You know, who knows? If you're saying we're going to be on that run rate starting now, it's not like we're looking backward. We're starting right now at a big number that gets to an even bigger number. The question is, in the next year, can they do that volume?
Yeah.
They might.
It's a big number. 500 million is a really, really, really big number in revenue.
It is, but we know that EMC are the 800-pound gorilla in the storage space, right? They've got arguably the best sales force out on the street. They've got the biggest customer base. And you know what? A lot of EMC customers won't look outside of EMC. It doesn't matter what the technology or the company is. So, I don't know. They've got a lot of fanboys. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I'm sure a lot of them have been well-earned over the years. If anybody's going to do that, it's going to be EMC. I mean, that is a massive number. Don't get me wrong. I can't imagine the rest of the all-flash players come anywhere even close to that. I mean, even combining them together, is there 500 million in that market at the moment?
That's what I'm saying. How can they? I can hardly believe it. I could believe it when it was a rumor, but now that it's in the earnings calls, it somehow has some type of credibility that they're actually calling the numbers themselves. Before that, it just came from some analysts and so on. But these are really, really, really big numbers in this market for a new product.
Now, I've got no idea how this works, but can they be giving customers an Extreme.io box? You know, let's say you buy 2 VMAXs this year, and you know what? We'll throw in an Extreme.io, but we'll fudge the numbers internally. So
how does that come into your revenue?
Well, if you say that
if you're giving it away, it's not a revenue number.
No, but if you work it on your numbers internally, that's saying, right, this is like a £4 million deal, and it's a couple of, you know, huge old VMAXs, and we throw in the Extreme.io, but internally we fudge the numbers so that the Extreme.io shows up as full price, but we more heavily discount the VMAXs. I'm not saying they are doing that, but yeah. I just wonder, is there a way to do your numbers internally like that so that they look better on the outside?
There's some likelihood of that.
Yeah, I can only say that I can hardly believe that number in revenue. I can hardly believe that. How they do it, I don't know. I would love to know.
So what are other people saying then? Because we need to get some opinions here from people that really understand how earnings calls and things like that work. Because that is a huge ass number.
Mm-hmm. It is. So what's the average selling price of one of those things?
Pass. Don't know.
I mean, it could be that they're selling, you know, large units, and they figure they're going to have enough of them out there.
I don't think they can be selling large units because I don't think it scales very well at the moment.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, it's just, I tell you what, my response is, if they set it on an earnings call, they must have a way to get there, because earnings calls are like cutting your finger and letting the blood run out and stamping it in public.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you cannot lie on an earnings call. That is...
That's what I was saying. I mean...
That's why my reaction is, if they said that in an earnings call, and I didn't see that, Hans, but if they did, there must be some realistic way for them to get there, because they're not that stupid. I mean, this is how you have, you know, activist investors come in and just, you know, clean your clock.
Yeah. Okay, guys, thanks for your time. Really interesting show today. Tons of stuff discussed, and I think some stuff that we probably need to go away and do a bit more research on, and maybe come back with some second opinions next week or the week after. But really appreciate your time, and we'll slide out with another secret Windows phone app.
Hello, this is Mark Farley, and you're listening to Secret Windows Phone Apps. And today, we're going to be talking about something that's very, very secret.
I love you.
Extra energy. Where does it come from? Can you get an app for it? Is it possible that you can solve your own energy problems with a Secret Windows Phone app? Yes, you can. Most smartphone owners have problems with energy with their smartphone. The battery runs out before they want it to, and it drops off in the middle of a call, or when they're searching for something, or using Google Maps. But the real question is, can the smartphone pick up your own personal energy? And that's what this Secret Windows Phone app does, is you take the battery out of the phone. And you might say, okay, you took the battery out of the phone. Now I don't have any energy at all. What am I going to do? And you put an energy bar or Fig Newton or some kind of small cracker or something like that in your phone. And then, when you personally run out of energy, you just take your Windows phone out of wherever it is and you have a little snack. You get the energy from that snack. So imagine that you're on a bus or an airplane or a commuter train and you feel yourself dozing off to sleep. Everybody else is probably on their phone, playing some games, doing some texting, reading some email or something like that. Doing something that's really not that much fun on your Windows phone. But instead you can take the battery cover off your Windows phone and take the cracker out and have a little snack. Those Apple fanboys are going to be wondering, what the heck is that guy with the Windows phone doing? And how long are we going to have to wait to get the iLunchbox? And who wants wearables when you can have edibles? Tune in again to hear another episode of Secret Windows Phone Apps.